it's a small room.
Yeah.
Shout it out.
Bill is a...
And anything you want to talk about, anything.
So, yeah, raise your hands. Bill will...
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, good. I don't believe that you feel very emotional about it. I want to get it right and be civil about it. I feel a big God gave me that, this, sir. I'm certain that I asked this question on behalf of tens of millions of my fellow Americans across the country, perhaps even a few in this auditory this evening. Mr. Ayers, since you willfully exploded bombs in acts of violent domestic terrorism against your own country, the United States of America, do you not feel, sir, profound guilt for these evil acts? And do you not feel morally compelled to express extreme remorse and to apologize to the citizens of this great nation, and especially to the brave veterans of this country who fought and died to preserve the very precious freedom which you so shamefully and disgracefully abused by perpetrating your vile acts of traitorous terrorism?
I take it there that you agree with everything else I said, so I will talk to that. But that's okay. It's all right to bring this up as well. And I will speak to everybody here. First of all, I make a huge distinction between being a patriot and being a nationalist. I'm a patriot, but I'm not a nationalist. Patriotism actually believes that are people who believe that the country should live up to its own standards as well as universal standards of justice and human rights. Nationalists, on the other hand, believe that their country is right no matter what it does, and that just couldn't be further from the truth. So I don't stand in opposition to patriotism. I stand in opposition to nationalism. Here and in every other country I can think of. In terms of the Weather Underground, which is what you're referring to, it was not a terrorist organization. We did.
Sure, what are you calling up bombs?
I'm happy to explain it to you. We did indeed, as an organization, we did indeed cross lines of propriety and legality, and we did break the law, and we also paid for the laws that we broke. We never killed anyone, we never hurt anyone, we never targeted anyone. On the other hand, and here's the dilemma, and this is a real dilemma, but as I said earlier, I'm not a tactician, I'm certainly not urging anything, but in 1965, when I was first arrested opposing the war in Vietnam, I was arrested in the draft board, destroying draft files, an act of vandalism. And in that moment, just to a little bit poke a hole in the myth of the 60s, and the 60s are highly mythologized. At that moment, at the University of Michigan, 39 of us were arrested. We were surrounded by thousands of students who opposed what we were doing. So the idea that it was popular is a myth. In fact, at that moment in 1965, 80%, 70% of Americans, I'll get to you, 70% of Americans, I'll get to you, I promise. I'll positively get to you. 70% of Americans supported the war in Vietnam. Something like 12% or 15% opposed it. And we demonstrated, and over the next 3 years, many, many things happened to change the texture of the country. And interestingly, you might recognize this, even those of you who are young. 3 years into the war, the tables had turned. And 3 years into the war, a majority of people opposed the war. So by 1968, maybe 55, 60% of people were opposed to the war, including, and importantly, veterans. In fact, there were three things that turned the country against the war. First thing was similar, a couple of these things are similar to today. One thing that turned the country against the war was anti-war organizing, and that meant more than demonstrating and getting arrested. It meant going door to door. In fact, the hardest thing I did in those 3 years was go into neighborhoods in Detroit and Cleveland and knock on doors of strangers and ask them to support the effort to end the war, the peace effort. It was very hard. It was arduous work. I did it day in and day out for years. That made a difference. Not the decisive difference. It certainly changed me. It's important for me. Second thing, that changed the country around the war was the Black Freedom Movement coming out, not unanimously, but importantly against the war. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1966 issued, they were the ones who led the bus, the freedom rides on the buses and the sit-ins at the lunch counters. They said in 1966, no black man should go 10,000 miles away to fight for a so-called freedom he doesn't enjoy in the United States. That was a huge, huge shaking kind of declaration by SNCC. Martin Luther King, and I know we have this mythology of King, you know, he had a dream, he led a bus boycott, he gave a speech, he won a Nobel, and then what? And he was assassinated. That's not the true story. The true story was an activist for 12 years who changed every year, became more radical every year. Read his speeches between 1965 and 68 when he calls for revolution again and again, not once, again and again. If you read one speech, go online tonight, write this down. April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed, and read the speech at Riverside Church, in which he calls for a revolution in values in order to join the right side of the world revolution. And he calls for an end to militarism, racism, and materialism. And he includes in materialism, consumerism. And he says, we're going off the cliff here. We're going off the cliff. So King urges black men not to join the army, not to join the service. And he says, I cannot condemn the ghetto rioters until I condemn the greatest purveyor of violence on earth, my own country. That was King in 1967. The third thing that happened in those 3 years was vets came home and told the truth. And they told the truth consistently and noisily. And the one that got the most attention and failed to live up to it 4 years ago was John Kerry. His proudest moment as a 23 or 24-year-old coming back from Vietnam was to go first throw his medals at the White House, and then go to the Congress and tell the old men who sent the young men to fight, to tell them that we committed war crimes every day in Vietnam. That's John Kerry in 1968. John Kerry said, we commit war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy. And that was true. And the country turned against the war. The country hated the war. Just like the vets coming home from Iraq are telling the truth, large numbers of them. And when they do, nobody likes it. And what's the debate? What's the debate in this country? Can we see the coffins? How pathetic. How absolutely pathetic. We have a press that has not been able to be on an American battlefield since 1975, and that's a free press. You can get more on the internet about Gaza or about Iraq or about Afghanistan than you can on the networks any day or on the cable any day. So it's insane, right? Today as well as then. The country turned against the war. And in March 31st, 1968, Lyndon Johnson stood up and said, as president, he said, I will not run for re-election. I will work to end the war. And those of us who had committed ourselves to ending that war said hallelujah. And we had a huge spontaneous outpouring in Ann Arbor, where I lived, and in other places. And we rallied, and we ended up on the steps of the president of the University of Michigan's home. His name was Robin Fleming. We were good friends then, and we're still friends. Robin Fleming had been the dean of the law school. I was the president of SDS. He was the president of the university. So we each had a bullhorn. And I was saying something articulated into my bullhorn. In fact, you know, you were asking me about this question of memory as a motherfucker, remember? Which is how I begin my memoir. Because memory is deceptive, is the point. And Robin Fleming, in his memoir, said that Bill Ayers and I often disagreed, but he was always determined and articulate. And what I remember about saying that night in 1968 was, fuck you, you motherfucker, and that was articulate for 1968. In any case, Robin Fleming said into his bullhorn that night, congratulations, you've won a great victory. A million people have been needlessly killed, but now the war will end. And he believed it that night, and I believed it that night fervently. We went home happy. And 5 days later, King was dead. And 2 months later, Kennedy was dead. And a couple of months after that, Henry Kissinger emerged from whatever swamp he was living at the time. And had a secret plan to expand the war. And so, against the will of the American people, against the will of the people of the world, the war didn't just go on, it escalated. And here's the hell of it. Every week that the war went on, 6,000 people were murdered. So what should you do? What would you do? And what's your responsibility? And I have never defended what we did or said it was a bright and brilliant thing to do. No. But I will say that in my own family, I have four siblings. And among the five of us, we made five choices. One of us joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing within it. One of us ran away to Europe. One of us went to a commune and built free land and free love. My favorite option. One of us went into the industrial corridor of the Northeast and tried to organize workers to oppose the war. And one of us founded the Weather Underground. Now tell me which one of those five had the right strategy. I would argue none of them. And tell me which one was completely crazy. I would say none of them. But that doesn't mean I'm defending myself or the choices I made. Certainly not commending it to you. But as I say, when 6,000 people are being murdered by your government, you have a responsibility to do something. And my four siblings and myself, each of us did something. And we're still good friends today, even though we did different things. So, another question. Yes, ma'am.
I read an article in the newspaper that was talking about how the way in which Obama is moderate is he pushes the envelope and then shuffles along its edges. And I was wondering if you think that that approach kind of to change, just, you know, very moderate, slow, but gradual and still progressive change is better than trying to take something, take a big chunk out of something. I mean, how do you think it works?
Well, I think most people, most theories of change are badly flawed. I mean, most theories of change, if you take a theory of change like, you know, kind of gradual progressivism, you can't say much for it. Or if you take a theory of change like Marxist revolution, you can't say much for it. Because the unintended consequences in all of those models, as models, are overwhelm what you intended to do. So I don't have an answer to your question about what's the best way to approach change. But what I do know is that if we, all of us, open our eyes, try to think through how to change the debates, how to change the discussion. You know, I was talking about how the metaphor around gay stuff has changed, and the metaphor around education needs to change. And you can think of a lot of examples. Every newspaper in America has a business section, but not a labor section. Isn't that interesting? I mean, we never question it. You know, we never wonder about it. When there's no section in the newspaper called human rights. It's called the world, but it's not called international human rights, right? So we need to change the discussion. But I don't think that, as long as you started by pointing at the Obama administration, I'll just reiterate.
For his approach.
I'm sorry?
For his approach.
I think that he is the President of the United States, and the President of the United States does what the President of the United States will do. But if you think that the President of the United States ought to make peace, or ought to, let's take one thing he said this weekend. He said we ought to lower the numbers of nuclear warheads, and we ought to work for a nuclear-free world. I agree with that. Now, let's make sure he does it. How do we do that? We build an anti-nuclear weapons movement. We say that we agree with Dennis Kucinich that we need a Department of Peace. Not somebody who works full time, gets up in the morning and works full time around peaceful alternatives. Look, no matter what you think about how great this country is, and in many ways it has been and is a great country, but no matter what you think about it, we have 150 military bases around the world. What the hell do we think that's going to do? And not only do we have 150 military bases, the entire world spends $2 trillion a year on armaments and war. We spend a trillion of that. So we spend half of what the rest of the world spends. So you could say, we come in peace. It reminds me of that science fiction movie, we come in peace, boom. You know, that's how the world sees us. Out of the World Social Forum, you know, one of the things also that we need to do to really make change, not answering your question, that's okay. One of the things we need to defeat what my friend Pauline Lippman calls the Tina hypothesis. What's the Tina hypothesis? There is no alternative. Right. We have to believe and we have to promulgate the idea that another world is possible. Can you imagine a world without nuclear weapons? I can. I want to. I want to work with you to make that imagination real. So what can we imagine? And what can we do to make that World Social Forum kind of reality come true? I was at a World Social Forum meeting in Brazil a couple years ago. And there were maybe 50 nations in this one workshop that I was in. The guy had a world map. And he asked people in the room, how many of you have an American military base either in your country or within the couple of neighboring countries in your region? Everyone put their hand up. Everyone. And then he said this, which I thought was interesting. I never thought of it. And he said, how many of you are from countries that have military bases within the United States? And everybody laughed, just like, absurd. Well, we wouldn't have an Italian air base in the Catskills, would we? That's insane. And yet, an American air base in the Italian Alps, that's sensible. What the hell? Who do we think we are? And not only an American air base, but around that American air base, all the things that come with it, bars and prostitutes and all the other crap that we bring with us. So, yes, I think the world has a good reason to distrust us, and I think we have a responsibility on the question of peace to raise very noisy voices about the fact that we need to learn to live as a nation among nations, not the uber nation, not that arrogant, sickening, slippery, the world's only superpower. That's, boy, is that going to be gone in an eye blink. You know, are you kidding? I mean, the rise of China, the rise of Europe, the rise of the South, forget about it. So how are we going to learn to live? And when I said earlier, and I'll stop with this, I haven't answered my son, but that's okay. I'm forgetting my son. One of the things, when I said before that we need to stop looking at Obama and start looking at ourselves, I was thinking about Detroit, which is a city that, you know, at the turn of the last century, had 500,000 people. In mid-century, had about 3 million. And now it's down to 500,000 again. If you want to see a bombed out, burned out, you know, core, you know, kind of shell of what industrial America once looked like, that's it. Go see Detroit. You'll see a hobo village as big as this town right on the outskirts of downtown. You'll see people, and yet, here's the other thing you'll see. You'll see people who are self-activated around changing their lives. I'll give you just one tiny example. I was so impressed with the activists there because they're neither whiners nor are they traditional demonstrators. They're organizers, and they're organizing in two ways. One is to press an alternative to what is. It's kind of endless kind of cycles of consumption and growth and empire. But at the same time, they're kind of self-sufficient freaks. So, I'll give one example. Went to a high school for pregnant girls in downtown Detroit, public high school. And as the city has declined and as neighborhoods have collapsed, these brilliant science teachers at this high school have been reclaiming the lots around the school. As the building is abandoned, they claim the lot. And what are they doing? Well, they started by gardening. But within 2 years, they weren't gardening any longer, they were farming. And by that, I mean they were producing surplus to sell in the city. So now they've got a farm. They built a barn 2 years ago, and somebody donated a couple of horses. Now they grow chickens and rabbits and a couple of other things that I don't remember and didn't quite recognize, and horses. They have two horses. And I'm there on a Saturday just poking around, and a couple of guys sitting on a stoop across the street in their early 20s come over, and I ask them, what do you think of this school? They said, oh, it's a great school, and we help with the barn, but mostly the girls do the work themselves. But we like the school. I said, what do you like most about it? This one kid says, well, the last Dominicks deserted our neighborhood 2 years ago, and I can still get fresh vegetables right here at the school, and I can come and get a chicken. They'll kill it and clean it for me for $3. And he said, that's pretty good. You know, so I'm not waiting for the grocery store to come back. I'm going to devote myself to the farm. Well, shit. You know, we should all devote ourselves to the farm. You know? That's what, I think that's part of where change comes from. I think that's part of where change comes from. You don't want to beg for a big box store to move into Detroit. You want to say, no, we're going to change our lives and we're going to take responsibility. We're going to do it right now. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
You said that
saying, gosh, do you guys have another hour? Because this is what I do. You know, I write about schools and change and education mostly. But let me just say, sticking with this idea that we're under these kind of controlling metaphors or these dominating discourses, one of the things that's making me crazy right now is that pretty much everybody in America, or the majority, or the media, or something, have drunk the Kool-Aid that education equals a product, or education is a commodity, like a box of bolts or a refrigerator, something you buy at the store, or you trade, you know, somehow. And the kind of dominant metaphor is that education is a business, and being educated, and you get an education like you get a product. The clearest indication of it is the cover of Time magazine on December 8th, 2008, right after the election. Do you remember this cover? You might have seen it. Michelle Rhee, R-H-E-E, the superintendent of the Washington, D.C. schools. You know, Michelle, are you from Washington?
I worked at the education lobby in D.C.
Okay, I'm afraid I'm going to put Michelle Rhee down. Sorry. Okay, sorry. I apologize, but I'm going to do it. The story has a beautiful picture of Michelle Rhee. She's a 38-year-old Korean-American woman. She's got a very fierce look, and she's wearing a power business suit. She's got a big slash of red lipstick and a broom in front. And it said the thing is, how to fix America's schools. And the pivotal paragraph in the story reads like this. Michelle Rhee has done more to reform Washington, D.C. schools in a year and a half than most reformers have done in a decade, colon. She's closed 39 schools, fired 280 teachers, fired 100 central office workers, and fired 39 principals, period. So it's like Enron or GM or something. She's run it like a business. There's not a word about bringing resources into this starving system. There's not a word about connecting parents to the schools. There's not a word about kids' motivation. Not even a word about test scores, which is supposed to be their bread and butter. The problem with the way we're talking about education is we're acting as if it's not a right and a process, but it's a product that you consume. So, one last point on this, it could go on forever, but not 2 points. One is that education, if you think about education in a democracy, ask yourself, what makes it distinct from education in any other system? Okay, so let's just take some other systems. Soviet Albania, fascist Italy, medieval Saudi Arabia, apartheid South Africa, all of those school systems wanted their kids to stay away from drugs and crime, show up on time, do their homework, master the subject matters. We want that shit too, right? So we all agree, right? Except we don't agree, because those systems also teach as a core value obedience and conformity. And you would think, at least theoretically, that in a democracy, you would teach the opposite. Not obedience, not conformity, but imagination, initiative, courage, entrepreneurialness. I don't know, a bunch of qualities that are not about getting in line, doing what you're told, finding your place on the hierarchy of winners and losers, and then averting your eyes when people are marched into the ovens. No, that's not what we do. That's not what we should do. And therefore, we should ask ourselves, are we living up to that democratic ideal? And finally, every government, every social system, every organized government, you know, the reactionaries like to say liberals want to tax and spend. That's such a dodge. Reactionaries want to tax and spend, too. Everybody wants to tax and spend. That's all governments do, as far as I can tell. They tax, and then they spend. And who they tax, and what they spend on is the only question. So, you know, in my view, and I think from your question, probably in your view as well, we ought to be spending much more on education, healthcare, and basic minimum standards of living. That's what we ought to spend on. And we ought to not spend on war, militarization, recruitment, ROTC, incarceration, and surveillance. Let's get rid of those things in favor of generous spending on education. In Illinois, we have within 5 miles of each other a school system that spends, you know, $35,000 per kid per year to educate their children, and a school system that spends $5,000 per kid per year. That's not worthy of a democracy, because then you're saying, you know what our policy is for children? It's simple. Choose the right parents. If you choose the right parents, it's all going to go swimmingly for you. If you choose the wrong parents, tough luck, buddy. Kick to the curb. That's not right. So, yes, education, you must change the debate, change the discussion. Yes, sir.
Thank you.